Now, we first of all need to define our terms, and I want to define evolution first of all so that you'll understand it's not just a little biological argumentation, it's a worldview. This is a definition of evolution that's been widely circulated because one of the leading evolutionists of the 20th century, probably the leading evolutionist, Sir Julian Huxley, is the author of that quotation and of that definition. Evolution in the extended sense, he says, is a directional and essentially irreversible process occurring in time, which in its course gives rise to an increase of variety and increasingly high level of organization in its products. And then he says, indeed, our present knowledge forces us to the view that the whole of reality is evolution, a single process of self-transformation. And you see the key elements of that definition, the whole of reality. So this is a worldview. It isn't simply a biological theory. It relates to everything. You have the definition of Theodosius Dobzhansky, which points that fact up also. Evolution is a process which has produced life from non-life, brought forth man from an animal, which may conceivably continue doing remarkable things in the future. Evolution comprises all the stages of the development of the universe, the cosmic, biological, and human or cultural developments. Life is a product of the evolution of inorganic nature. Man is a product of the evolution of life. And then if you want a briefer definition, my own definition, whatever it's worth, the evolutionary concept is the concept of the origin and ongoing development of all things by naturalistic continuing processes, with the net increase in complexity all the way from primeval particles to complex people. So we have a worldview that starts with chaotic particles in the beginning and the Big Bang or some chaotic stuff to begin with, then developing by natural processes, not supernatural. There's no external supernatural agent doing this. But just by virtue of its own innate structure and processes and systems, the universe is evolving itself all the way from particles to people. That's the evolutionary worldview, and so that embraces everything. You also have this marvelous little statement in the notes from Dr. René DeVos, who's one of the leading evolutionary ecologists of our time. And this is a sort of a self-serving definition because he says most enlightened persons now accept as a fact that everything in the cosmos, from heavenly bodies to human beings, has developed and continues to develop through evolutionary processes. And you note that that's still going on. So therefore, since evolution by these definitions is still going on by natural, continuing, ongoing processes, we ought therefore to be able to see it in operation. It ought to be subject to scientific experimentation and examination if it's still going on today. And so one of the first things we want to point out is that as we study processes that are going on today, we do not see any evidence of evolution anywhere at all going on today. But this is the essential aspect of the definition. It is a continuing natural process. Dr. DeVos goes on to say the great religions of the West even have come to accept this historical view of creation. Evolutionary concepts applied also to social institutions and the arts. The political parties, schools of theology, sociology, history, arts teach these concepts, make them the basis of their doctrines. Well, so that's the evolutionary worldview. Or graphically, we could also express it this way. Since there's a net increase in complexity, that doesn't mean everything increases in complexity, but the net is that way because over the ages, that's what's happened from particles to people. And as Dr. Isaac Asimov has said, in man is a 3-pound brain, which, so far as we know, is the most complex aggregation of matter in the universe. So primeval particles with no organization and no complexity, now the most complex thing in the universe, the human brain, obviously there's been a net increase in complexity if evolution is true. Now, the creation model, on the other hand, is just exactly the opposite. It says that there is a personal creator who has created all things in the beginning and therefore made them the way they ought to be, which was perfect in structure for the purpose for which they were created right from the start. So if there's been any net change in complexity, it cannot go upward as evolution requires, but must go downward because you can't go upward from perfection, and they started out perfect by the wisdom and the omnipotence of the creator. And so the creation model is opposite from the evolution model. And that's why it's inconsistent for a Christian to say, as many do, and as I once did, that you can believe in both creation and evolution. That's about like saying you can believe that the black is white or north is south. They're opposite in the very concept. Each is the opposite of the other. One is a net increase in organization with time. The other a net decrease in organization with time. And that's why we say we can discriminate between the two models on the basis of everything in the real world, since both are worldviews, And each is the opposite of the other, so that evidence for one is against the other, and against the one is for the other, so we can approach it from either direction, either positively or negatively, because there are only these two possibilities. Either we can explain all things, the origin and development of all things, in terms of continuing natural processes, or we can't, one or the other. And if we cannot explain all things in terms of continuing natural processes, then we have to explain some things, the basic things at least, the basic laws of nature, the basic categories of living systems and so forth, in terms of completed supernatural processes that are not going on in the present. So that's creation, the other is evolution. Have to be one or the other. And so that you'll see that I'm not the only one who thinks that, let me quote from one of the 40 or so anti-creationist books that have been published the past several years. This one is by Douglas Fatima, a book called Science on Trial. By the way, this is one indication of the importance of this subject to the modern Christian, because there have been some 40 books written in the past several years against creation by evolutionists, some even by Christian evolutionists, indicating that at least they're taking it seriously and they're trying to stop the creation movement. And this is one of those. And so naturally I wouldn't agree with much of what Dr. Fatima says, but this is one statement with which we would agree. He says, creation and evolution, between them, exhaust the possible explanations for the origin of living things. Organisms either appeared on the earth fully developed or they didn't. If they did not, then they must have developed from pre-existing species by some process of modification. If they did appear in a fully developed state, they must indeed have been created by some omnipotent intelligence. So we have these two possibilities, and only these two possibilities in the ultimate sense. And that doesn't mean that a Christian cannot be an evolutionist. I myself was a Christian evolutionist for a long time, all the way through college and for some time after. But it does mean you shouldn't be. It's inconsistent. Being a little bit facetious, but nevertheless, it does make a point. People say, can't you be a Christian evolutionist? Yeah, you can be a Christian evolutionist. You can be a Christian liar. You can be a Christian thief. Christians can be all kinds of things they ought not to be. And evolutionist is certainly one of them, because it's completely inconsistent with the scriptures, with consistent theism, and with true science. And so a Christian should not be an evolutionist. You can be, but it's not consistent to be. And we want to show you that it's not necessary to be. You don't have to compromise with the evolutionary system in order to be scientific and knowledgeable and effective in today's world. Let me read also from the foreword to The Origin of Species, 1971 edition, by Dr. L. Harrison Matthews, who's a prominent British zoologist. He's fellow of the Royal Society, is certainly a competent scientist, published many books and papers. And he says this, in the foreword to Darwin's Origin of Species, he says, belief in the theory of evolution is thus exactly parallel to belief in special creation. Both are concepts which believers know to be true, but neither up to the present is capable of proof. Now, that means that if creation is religious, then so is evolution. Both are concepts which believers know to be true. And the commonly voiced opinion today that creation is religion and evolution is science is simply wrong. Creation is every bit as scientific as evolution. Evolution is every bit as religious as creation. These tabulations sort of summarize the two worldviews, the creationist worldview, and in contrast, the evolutionist worldview. First of all, a self-existing creator God, or a self-existing evolving universe. Creation, the cosmos created by divine fiat or organized by itself. Basic systems completed in the past supernaturally. Systems developed by continuing natural processes in the present. Net changes downward toward disorganization in the creation model, upward toward higher organization in the evolution model. So this also helps point out the contrast between the two views. And to indicate that evolution is just as religious as creation, despite protestations to the contrary by evolutionists, I've just sort of summarized the religions of the world in terms of their creationist and evolutionist framework. And you notice that in the creationist framework, there are essentially just three modern living religions that are creationist: Judaism and Islam and Christianity. And there have been some heretical systems in the past, like deism and Unitarianism, that professed at that time to be creationist, although they wouldn't today, and Zoroastrianism. All of those are monotheistic religions believing in one creator God who created all things in the beginning, a transcendent, personal, omnipotent, omniscient creator God. Now, Islam and Judaism, as well as liberal Christianity, have to a large extent accommodated evolutionism by refusing to acknowledge that the Creator must also become the Redeemer and the Savior, and to recognize the triune nature of the Creator God. That's another topic that we won't discuss here, but the only Trinitarian monotheistic religion is Christianity. On the other hand, the evolutionary religions are all the others. And you notice how many there are in the pantheon of pantheism and polytheism, which are really two ways of saying the same thing. There's Buddhism and Taoism and Confucianism and Hinduism and animism and all of these others. All of these reject the idea of a personal creator God and a beginning of the space-time universe. They all consider the universe is ultimate. It never had a beginning. It may be going through many cycles in some of them, but it has always existed in one form or another. Space and time and matter have always existed. In contrast to the creation worldview, which says that the universe had no existence and was called into existence by God. And so there are many religions that are based, many living religions, and certainly all the ancient pagan religions are based on evolutionism. The ancient religions of Greece and Rome and Egypt and India and China and Babylon and all these others are evolutionary religions in the sense that they believed that the universe is the eternal reality, and then the forces of nature operate on the primeval stuff, whatever it may have been, whether it was water or fire or chaos or whatever. And these forces of nature become personified in terms of different gods and goddesses in many cases, like the god of the thunder and the goddess of the river and so forth. And these systems of nature then, personified polytheistically by gods and goddesses, identified also astrologically with the stars of heaven and the constellations, brought the universe into its present form. And so all of these are evolutionary systems. So if anything, evolution is much more religious than creation, because many more religions are based on evolution than on creation. And of course, all the atheistic systems, humanism, atheism, Marxism, and so on, all based on evolution. Now, I want to illustrate this by a couple of trees. The evolutionist tree, evolutionary tree, and I've said that evolutionary philosophy is the basis of all wrong doctrines and harmful practices that plague the world, past or present. And that's quite a statement to make. We don't have time to document all of it, but some of the more important problems and systems we do want to document just a little bit to show that they are based on evolution. Well, let's take humanism. And I've pointed out that the American Humanist Association, which was founded in 1933, of course, that wasn't the beginning of humanism, but as a formal organized system, it was incorporated as a tax-exempt religious organization in the state of Illinois in 1933. Been going on and gaining strength ever since. And at that same year, the Humanist Manifesto number 1 was published. And that's still very widely used and very viable today as a humanist document. And the first two tenets in the Humanist Manifesto of 1933 indicate that the whole system is based on evolution. Tenet number 1, religious humanists regard the universe as self-existing and not created. Second, humanists believe that man is a part of nature and that he has emerged as a result of a continuous process. So humanism is based on the premise, the assumption, that's all it is, just a raw assumption, that the universe has evolved by natural processes, was not created, and that man has evolved by natural processes. The universe and man, that would include then everything else in the universe. And you say, well, how is that any different from atheism? Well, as a matter of fact, it isn't, except that it's a little more genteel term, humanists, in the sense of the Humanist Manifesto and the American Humanist Association, are atheists, although they may have some believers in some sort of a nature God within the system, but certainly not a personal creator God. In a very recent issue of the Humanist magazine, on the back cover, the editor of the Humanist magazine defined humanism this way. In fact, the title of this little article on the back cover was How Do Humanists Define Their Beliefs? He says, humanism does not include the idea of a God, and as such is considered a philosophy rather than a religion. In a way, it is an alternative to all religions. However, whether or not one looks to humanism as a religion or as a philosophy to live by, or as a way of life, we believe is largely a matter of personal temperament and preference. Those caught up in its religious aspects know that it provides a vibrant, satisfying faith. Those who think of it as a philosophy find it both reasonable and adequate. So So understand that humanism is a worldview based on evolution, and generally with man conceived as the pinnacle of the evolutionary process. That's why it's called humanism. And so man becomes then the ultimate measure of reality. Now, very recently in, I think, the American Atheist, there was an article in which the author was saying he didn't want to be called a humanist. He'd prefer to be called an atheist. Because humanism made man a god, and that was just as bad as making God a god. It said man was evil too. And so I don't know exactly what his ultimate belief was, but humanism is essentially the same as atheism. Julian Huxley, who we quoted a while ago, was one of the men who helped found the American Humanist Association. He was the first director general of UNESCO, probably the number one architect of the system known as Neo-Darwinism. Before he died a few years ago, he was probably the world's top evolutionist. And he defined humanists this way. This is publicized in the American Humanist public relation literature. He said, "I use the word humanist to mean someone who believes that man is just as much a natural phenomenon as an animal or a plant, that his body, mind, and soul were not supernaturally created but are products of evolution, that he is not under the control or guidance of any supernatural being or being, but has to rely on himself and his own power." And then in this same brochure where I got this, he said the AHA, American Human Association, says humanism is the belief that man shapes his own destiny. It is a humanistic philosophy, a non-theistic religion, a way of life. So they acknowledge, when they're not aware that somebody is listening to them who might use it, that humanism is a religion. They say you cannot have creation in the public schools because creation is religion. But the fact is that humanism is the state-established religion of our public schools today to all intents and purposes. Maybe not officially in terms of specific legislation, but unofficially in terms of what is really taught in the schools is basically humanism, because particularly in the last Supreme Court decision about the Louisiana creation law, to all effect, it seemed that the very mention of God as a supernatural creator is banned from the public schools henceforth. Now, the reason why it's important then that we stress humanism is because it is the religion taught in the public schools. We need to be aware of it, and to do what we can to correct it in our churches or publications, whatever we can do. Another very vitally related point to that is that John Dewey, who is the architect of our public education system, more than any other one man at least, was one of the chief founders of the American Humanist Association. He himself was a humanist and boasted about that. He also made it very clear in his writings that he based his beliefs on evolution. He was an ardent Darwinian. Only more of a religious sort of a Darwinian, more of a New Age maybe type, but back in the early 30s. The current president of the American Humanist Association is Dr. Isaac Asimov, who is the most prolific science writer probably of all time. I suppose he's written more than 300 books of science. And he's written on every field of science, I suppose. And he is a good scientist, biochemist by profession and by his faculty position at Boston University, I believe. He is a good scientist, and he's written on everything, and he's the current president of the American Humanist Association. In an article in the Free Inquiry magazine, let me read what he says about his own personal belief. He says, "I am an atheist, out and out." And then he goes on and talks about how he changed from a humanist to an atheist. Really no difference, as he points out. But then this is particularly interesting, I think. He says, "Emotionally, I am an atheist. I don't have the evidence to prove that God doesn't exist, but I so strongly suspect he doesn't that I don't want to waste my time." Now, Asimov knows science as well as anybody, and so if there's any evidence in science that God doesn't exist to justify atheism, he ought to know it. But he says, "I don't have any evidence to prove there's no God." If he doesn't, then nobody does. In other words, people reject God not because the scientific evidence requires it, but because emotionally they don't want God. So you need to keep that in mind. We don't want to get so involved in the scientific argumentation that we fail to realize the real spiritual dimensions of this issue. Men are atheistic and humanistic not because of science, but because they don't like God. Basically it. Here's Julian Huxley again. This was at the keynote address at the Darwinian Centennial in 1959 when he was the number one speaker at that great Darwinian worship service. He says, "Darwinism removed the whole idea of God as the creator of organisms from the sphere of rational discussion. Darwin pointed out no supernatural designer was needed. Since natural selection can account for any known form of life, there's no room for a supernatural agency in its evolution." That's a key quote, I think, because there, this leading evolutionist of the 20th century, maintains that science has abandoned the existence of God. Well, he thinks of it as science, but he does acknowledge it's Darwinism. It's an ism that has banned God. Darwinism. And of course, if his premise is correct, then his conclusion is correct. If it is true that natural selection or Darwinism or evolutionism can explain everything, as he says, then there is no room for God and no need for God, and the very idea of God becomes redundant. It would be unscientific then to force a redundant factor into the equation when you don't need it. And so he's right. If natural selection can really explain everything, then you don't need God, and that's why it's so utterly inconsistent for a person to be a theistic evolutionist. If evolution really is needed to explain things, then you don't need God to explain things. You don't need two explanations for the same thing. So don't be inconsistent. Make a choice between evolution or God, but don't try to mix the two. There are other reasons, of course, for that as well. One other statement on atheism that you've probably seen this, but this is from the American Atheist magazine, and it points up what I'm saying here, how important evolutionism is to atheism. This is G. Richard Bozarth, The Meaning of Evolution. He says, Christianity has fought and still fights and will fight science to the desperate end over evolution, because evolution destroys utterly and finally the very reason Jesus' earthly life was supposedly made necessary. Destroy Adam and Eve and the original sin. In the rubble you will find the sorry remains of the Son of God. Take away the meaning of his death. If Jesus wasn't the Redeemer who died for our sins, this is what evolution means, and Christianity is nothing. And the sad thing about that is that that atheist understands that better than most Christians do. Now, with respect to the impact of evolution, not just on the philosophies like humanism and atheism, but on ways of living, let me quote Will Durant, who was a humanist. Just before he died, he made this statement. He says, by offering evolution in place of God as a cause of history, Darwin removed the theological basis of the moral code of Christendom. And the moral code that has no fear of God is very shaky. That's the condition we're in. I don't think man is capable yet of managing social order and individual decency without fear of some supernatural agency overlooking him and able to punish him. The interesting thing about that to me is that Will Durant was an atheist and a humanist, and he didn't think he needed God. But he thought society needed God in order to have a stable world order and social structure, that we needed to believe in God in order to maintain order on the planet. And of course he's right in the fact that we've pretty well abandoned God as far at the official levels of government worldwide, at least, and education has led to the moral chaos that we're in today. One of the last statements in Darwin's Origin of Species points up the same thing. He says, this is, I don't know how many of you read Darwin's Origin of Species. I would commend it to you sometime if you haven't read it. It's an amazing book to have had such a tremendous impact and to be so utterly empty of any evidence for evolution. One thing he never did was to show any evidence for the origin of species in his book called The Origin of Species. A lot of speculation, but no evidence, no example. Anyway, at the end of his book of speculation, he says this, thus from the war of nature, from famine and death, the most exalted object which we are capable of conceiving, namely the production of the higher animals, directly follows. By the higher animals, he meant including man as the highest. And so he says, man has been produced from the war of nature, from famine and death. In other words, by death came man. The Bible turns it around, you know, in Romans chapter 5 says, by man came death. The fact that man rebelled against God and his word brought sin into the world and therefore death into the world. And consequently, the idea of evolution as proceeding by the struggle for existence and natural selection and the survival of the fittest has led to all kinds of harmful practices and philosophies and systems. And we have some of these mentioned here, just a few of them. And I don't have time to document all of those, but some of the more important, for example, communism. Well, everybody, I suppose, knows by now that Karl Marx wanted to dedicate Das Kapital to Charles Darwin. They were contemporaries. And he said, in effect, along with Engels, that Darwin had given him the scientific support for his beliefs in economics. And so he really eulogized Darwin. But you say, well, that was a long time ago. Let me read something more modern. This is from Cliff Connor in an article written against the creation movement in one of the communist magazines, Evolution versus Creation, in Defense of Scientific Thinking was the title. This was in the International Socialist Review, the monthly magazine supplement to the Militant, November 1980. He says, defending Darwin is nothing new for socialists. The socialist movement recognized Darwinism as an important element in its general world outlook right from the start. Then he says, by defending Darwinism, working people strengthen their defenses against the attacks of these reactionary outfits, and they prepare the way for the transformation of the social order. We are revolutionary socialists, whose aim is, as Marx said, not merely to interpret the world, but to change it. And of all those eminent researchers of the 19th century who have left us such a rich heritage of knowledge, we're especially grateful to Charles Darwin for opening our way to an evolutionary dialectical understanding of nature. Whatever of problem the communistic movement has been to the modern world, and no doubt that it's created all sorts of conflicts, warfare, deaths by the millions, and so forth, the basis of it is evolution. But not just true of communism. Sometimes people think of Nazism as the polar opposite of communism, but of course they're just really two fruits from the same tree, both based on evolution. Here's from a very important book written by a man by the name of Daniel Gassman back in 1971. It's been widely quoted since. The Scientific Origins of National Socialism, Social Darwinism, and Ernst Haeckel and the German Monist League. Ernst Haeckel, if you don't remember that name, was a biologist, a German biologist, who was very prominent in the days of Darwin, and he was the German equivalent of the English Darwin, and his influence in Germany and the continental Europe was about the same as Huxley and Darwin in England. He was responsible, I suppose, more than any other one man for the acceptance of evolution on the continent, and particularly in Germany, and his system was not only evolutionary science, as he would call it, but he was very strong in philosophy, and he led the way to the German imperialistic system and militarism and social Darwinism. Nietzscheism was a component of that. Anyway, this is what this book is about. And so Gassman says, along with his social Darwinist followers, Haeckel set about to demonstrate the aristocratic and non-democratic character of the laws of nature. Up to his death in 1919, Haeckel contributed to that special variety of German thought which served as the seedbed for National Socialism. He became one of Germany's major ideologists for racism, nationalism, and imperialism. Hitler stressed and singled out the idea of biological evolution as the most forceful weapon against traditional religion, and he repeatedly condemned Christianity because it opposed the teachings of evolution. For Hitler, evolution was the hallmark of modern science and culture. He defended its veracity as tenaciously as Haeckel did. In fact, the very title of Hitler's book, you know, Mein Kampf, which means my struggle, was taken from the Darwinian idea of the struggle for existence. And he believed in the superiority of the Teutonic or the Aryan race as against other human races. They would eventually eliminate the other races. That brings up the point that racism also is based on evolution. And somehow modern liberals have gotten across the idea that racism is based on biblical fundamentalism. No such thing. All of the evolutionists of the 19th century were racist. In the most extreme sense, Charles Darwin's, the title of his book, Origin of the Species by Natural Selection, had as its subtitle, The Preservation of Favored Races in the Struggle for Life. And he didn't mean just varieties of plants and animals, because in his book on man, The Descent of Man, he makes it very plain that he's talking about human races too, and that, well, let me read, this is not from his book, The Descent of Man, although there's a very similar statement in that. This is from one of his letters. He says, natural selection has done and is doing more for the progress of civilization than you're inclined to admit. The more civilized Caucasian races have beaten the Turkish hollow in the struggle for existence. Looking to the world at no very distant date, what an endless number of these lower races will have been eliminated by the higher civilized races throughout the world. And of course, his main and protagonist, Thomas Huxley, Darwin's bulldog, as he was called, probably more responsible for the widespread acceptance of evolution in English-speaking countries, even than Darwin himself was. In one of his lay sermons, as they were called, in his book called Lay Sermons, said, no rational man, cognizant of the facts, could believe that the average Negro is the equal, still less the superior of the white man. And if this is true, it's simply incredible that when all his disabilities are removed, by that he meant he was referring to the American Civil War, which was a thing of his own generation, and therefore the slaves had been set free. When all their disabilities are removed, and our prognathous relative has a fair field and no favor as well as no oppressor, He says it's simply incredible that he would be able to compete successfully with his bigger brain and smaller jawed rival in a contest which is carried on by thoughts and not by bites. That's quite a statement for the leading evolutionist of the 19th century. And if anybody said that today, I don't know, I don't know what would happen to them. Nobody would dare to say that now. But the leading evolutionist of the 19th century did. And not just the 19th century, this is from the leading anthropologist of the 20th century until at least the mid-century, Henry Fairfield Osborne. And if you don't know that name, he was the director of the American Museum of Natural History for a long time. He was a very well-known anthropologist. He was the one who publicized, I don't think he discovered it, but he was the one who publicized the famous Nebraska Man, the tooth that was found in Nebraska about 1924 or so, and was going to be introduced by Osborne at the Scopes trial. He didn't get a chance to do it, but he was ready to, because this proved, you see, that man had evolved from apes and was very, very ancient. As you know, that Nebraska Man later turned out to be, once they found the complete skeleton, not just a tooth, but the complete skeleton, turned out to be not an ape or a man or an ape man, it was a pig, an extinct peccary. Anyway, that's Osborne, and here's what his statement was in 1925, and this was, or 1926 rather, in their magazine, Natural History, which is republished in Natural History in 1980 again. He says, if an unbiased zoologist were to descend upon the earth from Mars and study the races of man with the same impartiality that he studies the races of fishes, birds, and mammals, he would undoubtedly divide the existing races of man into several genera and into a very large number of species and subspecies. This is the recognition that the genus Homo is subdivided into three absolutely distinct stocks, which in zoology should be given the rank of species, if not of genera, stocks popularly known as the Caucasian, the Mongolian, and the Negroid. The spiritual, intellectual, moral, and physical characteristics which separate these three great human stocks are more profound and ancient than those which divide the Nordic, Alpine, and Mediterranean stocks. In my opinion, these three primary stocks diverge from each other before the beginning of the Pleistocene or the Ice Age. The Negroid stock is even more ancient than the Caucasian and Mongolian, as may be proved by an examination not only of the brain or the hair, bodily characteristics such as the teeth, the genitalia, the sense organs, and the instincts, the intelligence, the standard of intelligence, note this, the standard of intelligence, he said, of the average adult Negro is similar to that of the 11-year-old youth of the species Homo sapiens. One of the leading evolutionary anthropologists of the 20th century. And not only Osborne, but the other leading anthropologists, men like Hooton and of Harvard and Herdlicka, these were also evolutionary racists in the same sense as Osborne, and that point of view did not really become outmoded until World War II and Hitler's extreme racism, which so repulsed the world, his decision to eliminate not only the Negroes, but the Jews and the Gypsies and, if he could, the Protestants and finally the Catholics, everybody except the Nazis. It finally so antagonized the world that they had to rethink their whole approach to the study of human races. And now the very idea of race in modern anthropology is sort of banned. Many modern anthropologists have said we have to give up the idea of a race altogether. Well, I think it's interesting that creationists have been saying that for a long time. The Bible doesn't teach races. The Bible doesn't have the word race in it. It doesn't have the concept of a race. As far as the Bible is concerned, there's only one race. That's the human race. And it says in the 17th chapter of the book of Acts that God has made of one blood all the nations of men to dwell on the face of the earth. We're all descended from Noah and his three sons. And it was just one race. And so anthropologists are coming finally around to what the Bible has been saying all along. And I remember back in the time, Dobzhansky, the leading evolutionist after Huxley, he used to argue that the idea that there was that there were not human races was foolish, that obviously there were distinct human races. And that was the time that we were saying that there were no human races, they were all the same race. So I think creationists were ahead of the field in that area at least, and anthropologists have finally come around to it. But racism, you see, is based on evolutionism. Well, let's look at, on the other side, some of these evil practices, abortion, for example. Now, quite rightly, of course, Christians, I think, rightly are exercised about this modern evil of abortionism that has been plaguing our country. And a lot of opposition to it. Many organizations are devoted to fighting the practice of abortion and legislation permitting or encouraging abortion, and that's good. They ought to do that. But once again, this is a fruit. It's not the root. And if we're going to get the fruits purge out of the tree, you got to get the roots of the tree out of the ground. If you're going to get the weeds out of the garden, you got to get the seeds out of the ground. And abortionism is simply a fruit of the evolutionary philosophy. Now, of course, abortion has been with us for a long time, and not every woman who has an abortion or every doctor who does one is an evolutionist. But whenever anybody tries today to scientifically justify the practice of abortionism, they do so on the basis of evolution. And I think you can see why the argument against, the argument in favor of abortion, whenever anybody tries to justify it, scientifically or rationally, is that the fetus is not really a human being, and so it's really no problem to destroy it. Why is it not a human being? Well, this goes back to the old recapitulation idea of Ernst Haeckel in the 19th century once again. He didn't start it, von Baer before him, but he was the one who really promoted it and popularized it, the idea that the development of the embryo, not only in humans but all creatures, that the development of the embryo recapitulates the evolutionary history of the species. In the case of humans, of course, the idea was that the human starts out as a one-cell creature in a liquid environment, just like the primeval amoeba back in the soup or whatever. And then it develops into a mini-celled invertebrate, and then finally it develops a vertebrate, becomes a vertebrate in a liquid environment, like a fish. Now it develops gills and gill slits like a fish. It becomes a fish, in other words. Then a little later develops a reptilian characteristics, has a heart like a reptile. And then still later develops a tail like a monkey, and maybe fur. And finally, towards the end of the gestation period, becomes a human being. And of course, it's no great sin to catch a fish or to kill a monkey or something. And so as long as it's not just at the time when it has become human, why, no crime. Well, but it's based on recapitulationism, which has been demonstrated beyond any question to be completely fallacious. It's not true at all. The embryo does not recapitulate any evolutionary history. In the first place, it would any evolutionary history, although they used to cite that as one of the evidences of evolution. But even if evolution is true, the recapitulation theory isn't true, because the embryo doesn't ever become a fish. It never has gills or gill slits. They never function as gills or gill slits do in a fish. And it develops into completely different structures before it's born. Never has a tail like a real mammal or animal tail, and so on. It's never, and every knowledgeable embryologist, as well as biologist, with a few exceptions, maybe in the high school textbooks haven't caught up yet, but they all agree, and they have for at least 60 years, that the whole recapitulation idea is completely false. Let me just read this one statement about it. This is from a conservative columnist by the name of Joseph Sabran. I think he's a Catholic, but he's not a creationist, as far as I know, and he's not a fundamentalist. He says, I think that what these, and he's talking about a particular columnist who's writing about abortion, imagines is that the human embryo undergoes something like the whole process of evolution, as in the old adage that ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny. The adage has been discredited, of course, but this doesn't mean it's lost its power over the imagination of many modern people. They still suppose that the human fetus is, in the early stages of development, a lower form of life. This is what they mean when they say it isn't fully human. The abortion debate has its roots in two alternative ways of imagining the unborn. Our civilization, until recently, agreed in imagining the unborn child on the pattern of the incarnation, speaking of Christ. And you know that Jesus Christ, in the account of his conception and birth, was completely supernatural. In fact, didn't go through any kind of, it was supernaturally conceived, didn't recapitulate anything. And furthermore, it was human right from the start. In fact, Elizabeth, you remember, testified that the babe leaped in her womb for joy, John the Baptist, while an infant in the womb, at the news of the conception of Christ. Anyway, until recently, imagining the unborn child on the pattern of the incarnation, which maximizes his dignity, many people now imagine him on the pattern of evolution, which minimizes his dignity. My guess is that the popular theory of evolution appeals precisely as an alternative to the Christian view of man, which not only demands faith, but increases moral obligations. People who adopt evolutionism are not driven to it by consideration of the evidence. They like it without respect to the evidence. Because they're passionate creatures, it offers no moral impediment to their passions. Well, this could go on some length, and I want to get to the positive side of the coin, too. Not all negative. One other thing, though, maybe two. I've got to Read this. This was in a recent issue of a magazine which somebody sent to me. I don't take this one. Called Guide Magazine. It's a magazine for so-called gays. By Jacob Smith. In the beginning, homosexuality and evolution. And this writer, homosexuality, says this. Homosexuality is seldom discussed as a component in evolution, but it undoubtedly plays a role. And so he goes on to say that therefore homosexuality is good because it has contributed to evolution. Once again, though, the point is that evolutionary thinking is contributing, has contributed to the, as the root of all these fruits of the evolutionary tree, which most of us think are harmful. Talk about the drug culture, and we oppose that. Where did it come from? Well, of course, drugs have always been with us, but never have they been scientifically justified until recent years. And probably the first leading advocate of the drug culture in the intellectual world, at least, was Aldous Huxley, the brother of Julian Huxley, probably even better known than Julian, not a scientist, but a philosopher and writer. And he was the first one who really advocated widely and was listened to by the young people of his generation, which is now an older generation, to the effect that since we have abandoned God, and he made this point in his writings, and quite a number of them, we have eliminated God. God doesn't exist, but we still need these religious experiences that people who believed in God used to have. We need those experiences, and so we get those through drugs. And so he advocated the use of hallucinatory drugs as a means of having these experiences, which evolution had proved were beneficial to the human race, and he couldn't believe in God anymore, so he had to do it this way. And then his disciple, Timothy Leary, took it up, and others followed him, and pretty soon the drug culture of the 60s and 70s came along, but once again, based on the concept of evolutionism in place of God. Well, one other movement that is becoming prominent today, and that's the so-called New Age movement. It's not really new. In fact, it's very ancient. But it's called New Age or New Wave, and it, in its present form, it assumes many different forms. There are all kinds of tentacles out there, and it's pretty hard to categorize too much of this. There's some very prominent scientists involved in it, like Dr. Capra at the University of California in Berkeley, who's written a book on Taoism and modern physics and other books like that. Men like Wheeler, great physicist, and many others who are advocating the so-called anthropic principle, which is the idea that the universe itself has a mind and knew that we were coming along and so developed in an evolutionary sense because it was intelligent and could control its own development. The Gaia hypothesis, which among geophysicists is very popular today and others, ecologists, the American Geophysical Union, about as hard-nosed a group as you'd expect to find, had a convention in San Diego this year on the Gaia hypothesis. Gaia is the mythological name for Earth, Mother Earth, and the idea is that the Earth itself is intelligent and is a living organism and is evolving itself and its the various systems that operate in its skin and so forth. And so they were examining the Gaia hypothesis, and it was a very scientific sort of a discussion. There were some pro and some con, but the very fact that they considered it significant enough to have a convention about it indicates that they're taking it seriously. And so there's a lot of scientific aspect to this New Age movement. But on the other hand, there's a lot of very mythological, superstitious elements like astrology and witchcraft and all these things that are involved in it too. And many practices, to a large degree, the fitness craze and the food fads and so forth, these are all tied in with that. And if you want to read an interesting magazine, get the New Age Journal, which deals with all these different aspects of it. And much of it impresses you as you read it superficially to be very good. But when you realize that the one thing that's in common to all of these systems is evolution, then you begin to see, once again, the roots of the fruits. And one thing is sure, that all of these different fads and so forth that are associated with the New Age movement are based on evolution. Let me read Jeremy Rifkin in his book, Algeny. Now, Rifkin is a New Age movement man, although he's a socialist, and he doesn't necessarily agree with everything in the New Age movement. In his book, Algeny, is a very strong diatribe against Darwinism, very good in that sense. But here he's talking about the new view of evolution. Evolution is no longer viewed as a mindless affair, quite the opposite. It is mind enlarging its domain up the chain of species. In this way, one eventually ends up with the idea of the universe as a mind that oversees, orchestrates, and gives order and structure to all things. Then he ties in this to the idea of electromagnetic fields and what they're now calling morphogenetic fields. That these are fields that are emanating from the Earth. Now, one of the leading writers of the New Age movement is a woman by the name of Marilyn Ferguson, who's written a book called The Aquarian Conspiracy. The Age of Aquarius, you know, and this was a kind of a watchword of the 60s youth movements. Anyway, the Aquarian Conspiracy, and she ties it all together under that. But she said that they poll all the leaders of the New Age movement in all its different aspects, both scientific and otherwise, to find out who had most influenced them to become advocates of New Ageism. And the interesting result was that apparently the intellectual forebear of the New Age movement, in its modern form at least, was the sort of apostate Jesuit priest, Teilhard de Chardin. She said that was the one name that far outshone all the others in terms of his influence on the leaders of the New Age movement. Now, what did he believe? Well, he was a Roman Catholic priest, of course, and supposedly would believe in God and the Bible and in Christianity. He professed to. But his idea of God was that God equaled evolution. And let me just quote from him so you see I'm not making this up. Here's what he said. This was quoted at the funeral service of Dobzhansky. Dobzhansky was a leading neo-Darwinist who was a follower of Desjardins, and so, by the way, was Huxley and George Gaylord Simpson and the other leading neo-Darwinists. They all were close friends of Desjardins, who was not only a theologian, but also a paleontologist. He had his PhD in paleontology from the Sorbonne University in Paris. And he was in on the discovery of the Piltdown Man, and a number, including Stephen Jay Gould, think he was involved in the Piltdown hoax, although that hasn't been proved. He was also involved in the discovery of the Peking Man. Seemed like he was right there whenever any of these so-called ape men were found back in the 20s and 30s. Anyway, he was very influential. But Dobzhansky was a follower of his, and so they quoted Dobzhansky as approving this definition of evolution by Chardin at Dobzhansky's funeral service. This is from de Chardin. Evolution is a general postulate to which all theories, all hypotheses, all systems must henceforward bow and which they must satisfy in order to be thinkable and true. Evolution is a light which illuminates all facts, a trajectory which all lines of thought must follow. Now you can see that you just well substitute God for evolution in that kind of a statement. But here also from a couple of his books, just a couple of statements. In his book, Christianity and Evolution, he said, God cannot create except by evolution. God only creates by evolution. But God is evolution, of course. The world, its value, its infallibility, its goodness, when all is said and done, that world is the first, the last, and the only thing in which I believe. He doesn't worship the Creator, but the creation. And what about Jesus Christ? After all, he professed to be a Christian. And so he says, it is Christ, in truth, who saves. But then we must immediately add that at the same time, it is Christ who is saved by evolution. Here's another statement from Jeremy Rifkin right at the end of his book. He says, we no longer feel ourselves to be guests in someone else's home and therefore obliged to make our behavior conform with a set of pre-existing cosmic rules. It's our creation now. We make the rules. We establish the parameters of reality. We create the world. And because we do, we no longer feel beholden to outside forces. We no longer have to justify our behavior, for we're now the architects of the universe. We're responsible to nothing outside ourselves, for we're the kingdom, the power, and the glory forever and ever. Talk about humanism with a vengeance. But then he does end his book with this sentence. He's not all happy about this, in spite of the fact he thinks it's inevitable. He says, our future is secured, so the cosmos wails. Well, as I say, I need to look at the other side of this a little bit. Let's look at the creation tree. It's the basis of genuine Christianity and all right practice. Now, once again, there's much that we could say about all of these, and we don't have the time. But true Christology. If anybody ever says, well, don't preach creation, just preach Christ, You don't preach Christ if you preach a false Christ. You don't preach Jesus if you preach another Jesus, and the Bible warns us against both of those. Who is the true Christ? The true Christ is the Creator. He was a Creator before He became the Savior. You think of the marvelous Christological passage in first chapter of Colossians, probably the greatest in the Bible, on the theme of the person and work of Jesus Christ. And you notice in that passage, beginning about verse 16 of Colossians chapter 1, it talks about the past, present, and future work of the Lord Jesus Christ, who He is and what He has done, past, present, and future, the whole scope. And first of all, it says His past work, Colossians 1:16, for by Him were all things created, in heaven and in earth, visible, invisible, thrones, dominions, principalities, powers, all things were created by Him. And He's before all things, and by Him all things consist, and He's the head of the body, the church, and so on. So you notice the past work is He created all things, the present work, all things are being sustained by Him. In the King James it says consist. The Greek word is sustain, the one from which we transliterate our English word sustain. Or the idea is holding everything together, like Hebrews 1:3 says, He is upholding all things by the word of His power. So that His infinite power is holding the universe together, which He created in the past. He is maintaining it in the present. And verse 20 says, having made peace through the blood of His cross by Him to reconcile all things unto Himself, by Him I say, whether they be things in earth or things in heaven. Past, present, and future work of the Lord Jesus Christ. So true Christology begins with Christ as Creator and as Sustainer, which means also Savior. He is saving the world, which He created, and then Reconciler, Consummator in the future. And true evangelism. You do often hear people say, well, what we need to do is to win people to Christ, not to creation. But that's an inconsistent statement, because Christ is the Creator. And I think a very good illustration of this is in the fact that the one book of the Bible that was written to win people to Christ is the Gospel of John. That's the book, you know, we give to people that we hope to win to the Lord, and properly so, because that was the purpose that he had in writing the book. He builds it around seven great miracles of Christ. And then at the end of that discussion in John chapter 20, he says, and truly many other signs or miracles did Jesus in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this book. But these are written that you might believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you might have life through his name. So his very purpose in writing was to win people to Christ. This was a divinely inspired gospel written for the purpose of winning people to Christ. So I think that's probably the best way to do it, is the way he did it. And how did he do it? You remember how he starts out? In the beginning. Same was the words in Genesis. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. The same was in the beginning with God. All things were made by Him, and without Him was not anything made that was made. So that's the foundational premise on which the gospel must be built and evangelism must be structured, is the fact of special creation by the Word of God. That's the basis of true saving faith, as you read in Hebrews 11. You know, that great faith chapter, Hebrews 11, talks about the different works of faith. By faith Noah built an ark, by faith Enoch was translated, by faith Abraham went out, and so on. And right at the end of chapter 10, introducing Hebrews 11, it says, now the just shall live by faith, quoting Habakkuk for the third time in the New Testament. The just shall live by faith. So the faith it's talking about is the faith to live by, a living faith. And then it says, we're not of them who draw back unto perdition, but of them who believe to the saving of the soul. And the word believe is exactly the same with those who have faith to the saving of the soul. So it's saving faith. And what is the faith? Well, the very first object of faith mentioned in Hebrews 11 is in verse 3, and through faith we understand that the worlds were framed by the Word of God, so that things which are seen are not made of things which appear. How could it be any more plain? The very first object of a living, saving faith is to believe that God created all things by His Word. Not out of pre-existing materials, not out of things which appear. In other words, it eliminates the concept of evolution out of pre-existing materials. But by His Word, through faith, we understand that the worlds, and the word there is aeons, the word for, we could just well call it the space-time universe, was created not out of things which were already there, but out of His own Word. As Psalm 33 says, by the word of the Lord were the heavens made and all the host of them, by the breath of His mouth, He spoke and it was done, He commanded, they stood forth. And so that's the very first object of a living, saving faith. Now, it doesn't mean you have to preach creation to everybody to whom you witness. Unless they don't believe it, then you've got to start there, because until they understand that the reason they need to be saved is because they have offended their Creator and rebelled against His Word. It is important for the modern Christian, for these and many other reasons, to understand and to believe and to preach the truth of creation.